and the piano lesson based on August Wilson's Pulitzer Prize-winning stage play, Boy Willie was played by John Earl Jelks, Bernice by Rosalind Ruff, and Dogger by Stephen McKinley Henderson. Whining Boy was played by Anthony Chisholm, Avery by Leland Gant, Lyman by Chris Chalk, Grace by Marsha Stephanie Blake, and Maritha by Zachaire Dupuy. The creative consultant was Ricardo Kahn. Casting was by Pat McCorkle, and the pianist was Ernie Scott. The piano lesson was recorded at Crossroads Theater, New Brunswick, and the director was Claire Grove.
Well, for next Sunday's drama on three, in the second of his personal choices of 20th century dramas, the playwright Kwame Ikwe Amar has selected Shauna Case's classic play set at the time of the Easter Rising, The Plough and the Stars. And you can hear that at the same time, 8:30, next Sunday evening, here on BBC Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3 goes to the Royal Festival Hall for a performance by the London Philharmonic and a German pianist who now calls London home. Lars Vogt is one of the stars of the 2010 and 2011 BBC Proms, and on Wednesday night, there's a chance to hear him playing Beethoven's Emperor Concerto. After the interval, Bruckner's First Symphony will give Vladimir Yurovsky and his orchestra a real chance to shine. It's Radio 3 live in concert, Wednesday night from 7:30.
Well, now it's time for World Roots, and in a slightly shorter than normal edition, Lucy Duran heads to Scotland to explore the archive of the pioneering ethnomusicologist Jean Jenkins.
Well, it's a cool and cloudy day here in Edinburgh, and I'm on my way to the newly refurbished National Museum. And the reason why I'm going is because there's a wonderful exhibition of material that, in fact, has been in the museum for many years, since 1990. And this is a collection that belonged to a woman called Jean Jenkins, who actually played a very important role in my life back in the very early days when I was a student of ethnomusicology. She set me off down the straight and narrow track. And she made wonderful recordings. She was a real pioneer of ethnomusicology back in the 1960s and 70s. And it's going to be like meeting an old friend or an old mentor.
Today, we are going to talk about traditional music. And with me in the studio are Mr. Peter Kennedy and Miss Jean Jenkins, who has been recording music in East Africa. What have you been studying in Africa?
Oh, instruments mostly. That's, for example, I've been studying drums, all the different sorts of drums and who uses them and what occasions does he use them on, and do you use different kinds of drums for different kinds of dancing, that sort of thing. And I've been recording it, of course.
Why did you take all this interest?
It's my job.
So I'm going to meet the curator of this collection. As she herself has a fabulous title. She is the Keeper of World Cultures. What a great thing to be. And her name is Henrietta Litchi. Tell me what you know about Jean Jenkins' life, Henrietta, because I just met her from time to time and I'd never pieced together all the various strands of her life, which was quite varied.
It was full and varied. She gets a letter from her sister in the 1950s who says to her, "I think you must lead one of the most interesting lives of the people I know." She came to the UK in 1949 with her first husband. Prior to that, she was obviously born in the States. She'd worked in the Ozarks in Arkansas, and later on in life that became quite a significant aspect of her background. But in fact, she was born in New York She was Jewish. She had an early interest in folk music and singing. Apparently, she used to sing in choirs when she was a child. She lived in a fairly mixed area of New York, so the Bronx. And then she was a union organizer. She was a civil rights activist. She met her first husband in Detroit. And she obviously was part of the folk scene in New York.
When I first met her, she quite candidly told me that when she'd been singing folk music in Arkansas and working with African-American musicians, that she was threatened, harassed, and she implied that she was also raped by the Ku Klux Klan.
It's interesting you say that, because there are a series of letters that she writes in the 70s where she is sharing very personal information with someone, and she does mention having been assaulted or some very traumatic event having happened to her in Arkansas in the 40s, obviously, which is just prior to when she came here. And I think it's also important, you know, she was a communist organizer, she was Jewish, she had a record of civil rights activism, and
not a good thing in the 1950s in the USA, well, during the McCarthy period.
That's right. And when she was due to leave, which is 1954, is the period of the Rosenberg trial and the Rosenberg execution. So we forget about those aspects of American political environment.
Then she came over here to the UK.
She got a job as a temporary cataloguer at the Horniman in 1954. She became an assistant curator in 1956, and then she became the keeper of musical instruments in 1960. She seemed to have pursued a PhD program at SOAS, and she was looking at the Morin Kur. She was looking at Central Asian music.
Oh, that's the horsehead fiddle.
The horsehead
from Mongolia.
So she went to Mongolia, she went to Central Asia. That's the first foray that she gets into in the 60s.
When I first went out to Central Asia, I was in fact looking for the origins of a number of Indian instruments. I found some of them, of course, but that wasn't at all what really interested me about the trip. I went out there and heard a lot of music that I'd not heard anything like at all before. And it was my first field trip. And from then on, I heard music which connected up with Central Asia. Every single time I have taken a field trip, I have heard something which connects up in one way or another.
Yartak Solo, played by Mongol. Gobi Altai, Mongolia, 1974.
Well, the one thing you never get to do when you come and see a collection at a museum is to go behind the scenes and actually be admitted to the office of the Keeper of World Cultures. And that's where we are right now. And it's full of books and folders and files, as one might expect. And right in front of us are three special archival folders, Henrietta, that you prepared to show us, which are artifacts of Jean Jenkins, that is, notebooks, photographs, this kind of thing. So tell me what the scope of her collection is and how many recordings we're talking about.
Her recordings really are in three types. There's the recordings that she made of music around the world, and of those we have about 650 tapes. So you're talking about 7,000 individual tracks. Then there's a series of recordings of her singing, and we don't know when she made those recordings, but they're her singing folk songs, and they vary in their melodious quality. Then she was quite diligent about recording her own broadcasting. She did a lot of broadcasting in the 60s, so she did the music of West Africa and the music of Africa on the BBC, and so we also have those. So we have her recordings embedded in those as well. So it's a huge amount of recording that we have from her. Her earliest recording vis-a-vis travelling around the world is really the 1960s. So 1960 is the earliest recording. And that goes on to 1979. So we've got 20 years of her recording. So that's pretty much when it finished.
Woman singing with choral response and hand clapping. Wahehe people. Erenga, Tanzania, 1961.
this? Musicologist to pay, fifth visit to Ethiopia. This is like a press release dated 1968. That will have been around the time when I first met her. I first met her in 1970.
Right.
I was about to go to Libya to make some recordings in Libya. Somebody said to me, why don't you go and ask Jean Jenkins what it's like to record in the field? I had done field recordings, but I'd done them in Greece.
Right.
And the assumption was that it would be in an Arab country and it would be different, especially as a single young woman, as I was then. And it was very interesting meeting Jean Jenkins. She was such a sort of flamboyant and brazen and feisty character. You know, when I said, well, can you give me any recording tips? She was like, oh, don't bother with that. You'll be fine with a tape recorder. What do you have? I said, are you a... Oh, you'll be fine with that. She said, the important thing is wear lipstick. Your lips will get so cracked in the desert. And then she said, and watch out for the men. No man will ever really sincerely be trying to help you. They'll always be trying to get under your skirt.
She has a line in one of her letters from Malaysia when she's talking about what it's like travelling on a plane. I think she's going to Dubai. And she's very pleased that she's been wearing a wedding ring because she thinks it affords her a great deal of protection, despite the fact that by that point she'd already divorced her second husband. So I think she had this tremendous character and this extraordinary energy when she talked about what she was doing. And I think she had a determination and a force of character and a conviction about the way she did things, which is seductive if you're reading about her, you know, as someone who lived and
possibly
worked.
Not very English.
Not very English at all, I don't think. Certainly not very establishment. One of my favourite photographs of Jean Jenkins is this one. And basically she's sitting there quite modishly with her hand on her hip in a slightly sort of short dress, which is quite nicely designed with a frilly neck and a string of pearls. And that's fairly early on in her travels. I mean, I think of her life as being in several stages, but this is early in the 60s when she started being this kind of ethnomusicologist and she was travelling and she was going to Ethiopia a lot. And it's one of the few portraits we have of her, because after that, typically there's a photograph of her recording. So someone else is taking a photo. And I don't know whether or not she was getting people to take photographs of her recording because it made her look more serious. But this one seems...
Well, it proved that she was genuinely doing it.
Proved that she was genuinely doing it. Whereas this is... She just looks like a...
She actually looks very glamorous in it. She's blonde.
Curvaceous.
She's got a very... She's curvaceous. That's the right way to say it. She's blonde. She's got a broad smile. She's got rather full lips. She's terrific looking.
Kafil Asmaran, solo song with Masenko. Asmara, Eritrea, 1965.
Right here is a spiral notebook, Ethiopia, 1965, January.
As she starts to collect recordings more seriously, she also becomes more of an anthropologist. She becomes more of a documenter of what her travels. So in the 60s, when she's going to Tanzania and when she's going to Nigeria, and we believe she went to Tanzania at the invitation of Julius Nyerere.
Tanzania's first president.
And so she always told the story that she was asked by him to record the music that was in Tanzania at the time when he became the first president. She doesn't really name the musicians, but she's recording schoolgirls singing, going to school unaccompanied, and she's recording Independence Day music. And I think if one thinks about her background in folk music as a sort of active socialist, someone who was interested in kind of working culture, so when she goes to Mongolia and when she goes to the Soviet Central Union, she is recording what she calls work songs, so the songs that people sing to the sheep or the songs that people sing to the cows as they're milking them, and she's really interested in that because she thinks of that as a kind of real form of music. Equally, she's thinking of Independence Day music or the sort of songs that are happening around that moment. And so she's listening to popular political songs.
Quite often what you get is the sort of song which would accompany a political leader to a meeting, for example. It's usually a lot of drums, loud instruments, and so on. One of the nicest ones that I ever recorded, I think, was immediately after independence in Tanzania. President Nyerere had a big meeting down in the southwest of the country, and I recorded this.
She's also quite interested in pop music. She's interested in the influence of Western culture on Africa at that time and on African culture on the West. So she's interested in music as this kind of interchange between people.
Because that's very unusual for the time. The idea at the time in the early 1960s was that only traditional music was worth recording and studying and preserving for posterity through recordings. So the fact that Jean Jenkins was interested or saw the potential of popular music in Africa as a music that actually was very indigenous, I think that shows just to what an extent she was a pioneer.
My sense is that she was deeply immersed in music as this form, and she just wanted to track it in all its various manifestations. She also records sometimes off the radio, just because she's recording the popular music that other people are listening to.
For example, if you take a guitar, which now you can find all over Africa, of course, but if you play a guitar after you've been playing another instrument, a lute or a lyre, you tend to adapt the style that you know from your childhood onto the new instrument. And therefore you get a style of playing which, to my mind, is very attractive indeed. And if you listen to Jean Bosco on a Congolese guitar, you'll hear it's quite different from what you might have heard in a rock and roll session at the same time in Europe.
It's African guitar music.
Very much so.
Mama na mwana tumbana tujali bisutele. Na mwana tumbana tujali bisutele. Mama na mwana tumbana tujali bisutele.
She often talks of frustration, so she gets somewhere, so when she's in Malaysia, she talks about the frustration of not being able to go in country, because actually what she wants to do is record traditional music from tribal peoples in Malaysia. And she'll do anything. She gets herself into quite the pickle, you know, she ends up sort of being upturned on a boat, but because she's covered her Nagra recording equipment in 5 plastic bags, it's completely fine. And she's recording things. You have this feeling that she lands and all she wants to do is record and move and record and move and record and move. And she just wants to get as much packed into 3 weeks as she possibly can.
This is the repeat of the first tune, which is known as Ketawang. Begin.
Ketamang on gamelan, in Kuala Terengganu. Malaysia, 1972.
Here's a wonderful list, handwritten list by Jean Jenkins. When does it date from?
I think that's pretty much probably from the mid-60s, so 65, one of her earlier trips when she was...
Obviously to Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia. Yeah.
She obviously thought that she was going to be in different kind of social contexts, I would say.
Well, you can say that again, because it's clothes. The list is of clothes, presumably, that she would want to take. And one is for field work. And the other one is for town. So under fieldwork, she's got grasshopper shoes, brackets Addis, and socks. Skirt and blouse, Addis. Two wide skirt cotton dresses, one pinafore. Two cotton blouses, high neck, long sleeves. All right, town, this is great. Lace shoes, 10 pairs of stockings, good suit and coat. Three good blouses, two pinafores, two cardigans, six panties, brackets in Addis. Three bras, and now we're getting really personal, brackets in Addis. So when she was out of Addis, she didn't wear a bra. Sorry, two slips, one girdle, two pairs of shoes, medium heels, yes, one small, one large handbag, 12 handkerchiefs.
It cracked us up because the thing that she has in greatest quantities are the stockings and the handkerchief. But later on, she swore that she only travelled with two dresses.
But you know what? That was probably her story, because this is a reality. This is her own handwritten list of the things that she was going to take.
But if you remember the photograph of her in Ethiopia, she was very well turned out.
Inside the walled city of Harar, Ethiopia, 1965.
One of the really important projects and influential projects of Jean Jenkins was something called Music in the World of Islam. Can you tell me what that was?
Well, from what we know, she was working really between sort of 72 and then 74 to 76, recording and surveying music from around the Islamic world. And it was for an exhibition that happened at the Horniman Museum called Music and Musical Instruments in the World of Islam, which had both her slides and her recordings and the instruments she collected. But it was part of a larger celebration of the world of Islam that was happening around London at the time. So there were musical events, but there was also things happening at the British Library, at the British Museum, and in other museums around the country. So she very actively contributed to that. Her agenda was to bring the whole range of Islamic music to the attention of a British audience. It's exposing people to things that they don't know about, and it's making instruments that are in cases mean something.
Song of Welcome, near Bagh, Afghanistan, 1974.
Bye-bye.
She did have patrons. She had people who funded her because she often ran out of money.
Not surprising. I mean, these trips must have been very expensive.
I think they were.
It's a labour of love to go around the world making recordings.
And she also made sure that she always had the best recording equipment. So I think she was spending a lot of money or always trying to kind of, for want of a better term, hustle. She had a Nagra. And I think when she was humping it around the world, there's a young ethnomusicologist who refused to carry it because it was too heavy. So she was always very diligent about how she recorded and where she recorded.
And I see that there's a letter of hers to His Majesty Haile Selassie, Ethiopia's last emperor.
It's dated the 7th of February 1974. It says, "Sire, first permit me to express my humble good wishes to your Imperial Majesty. In order to save your Majesty's precious time, I shall attempt to be as brief as possible." She then introduces herself and the various trips that she took between 1962 and 1968. And she's bringing to the attention of His Majesty the fact that in 1969, he allowed her a certain amount of money, 1,000 Ethiopian dollars, to subsidise her work, and is really wishing for further subsidy because she has said that she's spent £4,600 out of her own pocket to go to Ethiopia and over the five trips to make musical recordings.
In order to save His Majesty time, I'm glad it was a brief letter because it's 4 pages long.
It is.
With a lot of detail.
And a very respectful language.
I guess if she was going to be spending time with Haile Selassie, none other than the Emperor of Ethiopia, she'd need lots of stockings. And possibly a girdle.
Possibly a girdle.
Breathing Song, Asabe Teferi, Ethiopia, 1965.
The real uniqueness of this collection is the fact that it is so broad and so deep and so really at one level undiscovered, because you're very familiar with June Jenkins' work, but there aren't that many people in the world that still are, even though some of her recordings are out there, and possibly don't understand the uniqueness of her journey through music over a period of 30 years, really. And so I think, given her legacy and given what a pioneer she was and what an extraordinary singular woman she was, because there's a lot of her character in this collection, that we have to sort of understand it.
But ultimately, you know, whereas a musical instrument is an object, the performance on that musical instrument or the piece of music that was recorded at the time, that's so ephemeral, and if you don't record it, it's gone forever, and music changes so much. And so what a fabulous thing to have this wonderful collection, which actually allows us to go back in time and hear what music was like before wars, before occupations, before all kinds of things happened.
Before the concept of world music happened, in fact, even. And I think that that's what's most extraordinary about it, is that she was kind of inventing a concept on her own and surveying things. And it's an amazing ability to be able to go to one person and find this music, and all the varieties of music, from court music to music that was known as tribal music to music that's the work songs or the political songs. It's just an extraordinary resource.
Well, you have been travelling in East and Central Africa, but did you meet at all people, I mean African people, who are interested in what you're doing?
Oh, yes, always. How do you think I got the music? If there hadn't been Africans that were interested in it, I couldn't have got anything. No, very many of them were interested in what I was doing, and very many of them agreed that it needed doing. The only thing is, of course, that in all new states, they always say, oh, well, you know, we must have a school here first, and we must have a hospital here first, and so on, and the music tends to get ignored. And this, I think, is dangerous, because, in fact, it will die out.
World Roots was presented by Lucy Duran and produced by Peter Meanwell. And you can see photos of Jean Jenkins on the Radio 3 website. It's 11 o'clock, time now for Jazz Lineup, presented by Claire Martin.
And on today's show, I've got highlights of a very special concert set from piano legend Mokoi Tyner's recent performance at this year's London Jazz Festival. That's coming up a little later on in the show. And Kevin Legendre is here to unearth another jazz classic from the vaults in this month's Now's the Time feature. So, Kevin, what have you picked this month?
Tanya Maria's storming Brazilian soul funky classic Come With Me, which has amazing music that sounds like this.
Thanks, Kevin. Looking forward to talking about that album a bit later. We're also coming up on the show today, concert tracks from Gilad Atzmon and the Orient House Ensemble, recorded at this year's Scarborough Jazz Festival. Well, to start things off, saxophonist Nat Birchall gets us in the mood with a track from his third release, Sacred Dimension, which is a clear progression from his two most recent albums. This time, Nat has a new drummer, Andy Hay, who he describes as a force of nature. And harpist Rachel Gladwin, who is featured on all of the tracks, brings her own folk-tinged take on jazz harp to the fore. Adam Fairhall is on piano, Nick Blacker is on bass, and the percussion is played by all of the band who are just handed out percussion instruments on the day of the session and told to play what they feel. All very organic. This is Dance of the Mystic.